stories don't define you. How you tell them will. Hi, I'm Sarah Elkins, your host and chief story maker of Elkins Consulting.
When we share stories, whether in our personal or business lives, how we share them makes a difference in how we remember them and in how we're perceived by the people we're sharing them with. When you're listening to this podcast, I encourage you to listen and consider your own related stories. To listen and think about which stories in your life might have impacted you in a similar way. And think about how you share those stories and the messages they carry for you and for the people who are hearing them. Well, I'm honored today to be interviewing John Shinnerer, Dr. John Shinnerer. He got in touch with me, I think, through Givitas. Is that right, John?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. So Givitas is a reciprocity circle that I recommend people take a look at. Givitas, through the Adam Grant and his work, and Larry Fried, they started this.
And Wayne Baker.
Yeah, and Wayne Baker, right. And they started this great website where people can ask for help. And I know that I struggle with asking for help, and most of my friends do as well, but I love offering help. And this is one of those opportunities where you can do both and feel really good about it. So Dr. John and I connected via Givitas, and I'm so grateful because what an interesting transformation you experienced and started your own podcast. Why don't you tell me a little bit about that before we get into much more depth?
Okay, let's see. My fiance asked me if I wanted to go to a Dan Millman retreat in Costa Rica with her. And Dan Millman, for those who don't know, is kind of a former Olympian level athlete. He was a great gymnast at UC Berkeley. And he wrote The Way of the Peaceful Warrior along with 14, 15 other books. But so I said, yeah, that'd be great. And we went, and Dan was great. But even better were the body workers at this resort. It's Pura Vida Resort. And they were just next level. Like there was masseuses. There was like a guy that does water worker. He works you in the water. But this one lady that my fiance had done a class with a year or two prior, she said, oh, we got to do this. This is awesome. And I said, great. And it was sort of like a musical meditation. And so we go in there, there's about six people, and you got like yoga mats and, you know, a towel that you lay on. And so you basically are getting into a very deep, relaxed state. And then she has these instruments that she expertly uses to guide you on this guided imagery tour of your mind, so to speak. But the instruments are like huge singing bowls or shamanic chimes or a shaman's drum that is stretched with elk skin, like all these kind of cool instruments. And so she got us laid down and got us relaxed, and then started talking about how, you know, you're entering a forest, and, you know, your spirit animal kind of comes to receive you there. And then you get on the back of your spirit animal. And then she kind of said, you know, see where your spirit animal takes you. And so I thought this was great. I was just like, all right, I'm going whole hog. And so I get on the back of this elk, and we jump over a small creek and eventually wind up in this natural cave. And in the very back of this cave was a treasure chest. And I'm like, oh, cool. I love treasure chests. And so I opened up the treasure chest, and inside was all this technological instrumentation. There was like a microphone, there was an amp, there was a laptop, there were headphones. And I was like, ah, oh, shit, I gotta do a podcast. And, you know, so one of the things I thought about calling my podcast The Reluctant Podcaster, because, you know, I don't know if you got this, but I think at some level it's always scared me a little bit to really put my true self out there, because to do so means that you also put yourself out there for criticism, judgment, the haters, the trolls. And yet I also know at the same time that I have an obligation to share I suppose you would say, my teachings to a wider audience. That, you know, one of the things ever since I got my PhD at Cal was I realized that there was great tools buried in these scientific studies, proven in research, but written in language that nobody could understand. And so my mission at some point became to simplify the language, to simplify the tools, and to find the best ways to share those tools with a much broader audience. And part of that becomes, you know, to your forte, part of it becomes storytelling.
Mm-hmm. I keep going back to this cave and that the reluctant caveman. Tell me, or the reluctant podcaster, tell me the name of your podcast again so our audience can hear it.
Well, what I finally settled on is the evolved caveman. And I love that. And I think people respond to that instantly. They get it. It's like, okay, yes, there's part of us that's caveman. And then we have an obligation to evolve past that. I had a client on early and he kept referring to himself as the evolving caveman. And I was like, oh shit, just missed it. Because, you know, evolved states that I'm done. That
yeah,
I've finished,
it that implies better that you've already done your work.
It's not true, right? So it's, and I think we're all evolving until the day we die. And so, sometimes you shoot for the stars and you fall a little short.
Yeah, well, except that you're kind of describing what an evolved caveman would look like. So think about it more.
I'm trying to.
As in terms of a goal. Yeah, obviously the goal is
to become
evolved. Exactly. So you're giving people tools to have a vision of evolved, even though
And that's always a question that comes up when you're working with values is, you know, are these values aspirational or are they present right now in me?
Right. Well, that goes back to, you had me at Dan Millman. Because the way I became a warrior was my Bible when I was in college, and I heard the name come out of your mouth, and I thought, oh, I need to reread that book, and I need to give it to my boys. Because it really...
Well, and if your boys play any sports at all, there's Mind-Body Mastery by him.
Yeah, they don't.
You know, Phil Jackson, when he was coaching the Bulls, said, this is a book that I have my players read every year.
Oh, wow. Well, maybe we'll look into that even though we're not athletes because we do a lot of physical activity. We do a lot of camping and hiking and fishing and kayaking. And so I'm sure that they could relate to that one as well. But yeah, oh my gosh. Let's go back just a little bit.
Okay.
I normally ask my guest at the beginning of the conversation to share something about themselves that most people don't know, but I'm guessing that you just gave that to us in the story of how you decided on your, first of all, to do a podcast, and second of all, the name of it. So I would rather go back and just ask you a little bit about what you do, just so that our listeners have some context for who you are and why we jumped right into that depth.
Okay, well, I'm still trying to figure out what I do. I do a variety of things. I mean, I've been a school psychologist. I've been a CEO. I've been an author. I've been a radio show host. Right now, I coach men. That's the most basic. I coach men towards greater success and happiness at work and at home, because it's my belief after studying positive psychology for some 20 years that if you don't have all four of those, you have none of them. And, you know, I've worked with men for many years. And what I found was that I was working with a lot of executives or upper management that had just done really, really well in their professional career. And some of these men were worth a lot of money, you know, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars. And their biggest point of pain was actually at home with their spouse. And at this point, typically their teenage children. And it fascinates me that, you know, this value that we start off with when we start our professional career of supporting the family, which is a man box culture value, which I think has a lot of merit to it, it gets morphed and cancerous over three decades. And where once we were focused on our family as the top value, it gets
muddied.
It gets lost in ego in climbing the corporate hierarchy, in making more money, in feeling more important. And by the time you're 50, you know, you've got a spouse that's annoyed with you because what she really wants is your time and attention, and you don't have much of that, or energy, and you have none of that left to give. And your kids are angry with you because they have every material item they could want, but
none
they
of
don't
love
have
and
you.
Attention, right? The things that they really want.
So I do that. I host a podcast. My fiance and I just did a global virtual summit to serve people during the pandemic. So we interviewed 28 experts, thought leaders around a variety of topics on leadership, relationships, parenting, hope, purpose, mm-hmm. anxiety, depression, anger, all sorts of things, and just kind of offered them out there one a day for free. And now I think you can get them for $67 or something, but that content was spectacular. So I speak, mm-hmm. I do interviews, I coach. I'm trying to help men evolve.
That makes so much sense, especially having been married to one for 23 years. So not that evolved.
We can go into the man box culture if you want, because that to me is a fascinating idea.
Well, I would like to do that, but in the context of your own journey. So when did you realize that you were in that culture and that you wanted out? What was the experience that you went, oh gosh, this is not okay?
Boy, Sarah, you are a good questioner. Excellent question. So let's see. If I go back to middle school, I mean, I remember I was in sixth grade. I was about, I don't know, 11. And I thought I was the only boy who felt things deeply. So I felt like a fish out of water most of my life. And I remember at that point in my life, I was a very good smartass. It's what you do in the man box culture to survive. It's how we relate to other boys, you know, put down sarcasm, one-upmanship, all that stuff, insults. And I remember I was being a smartass one day, and I, you know, I'm sure I insulted somebody or said something stupid and cruel, but the school bully, an eighth grader who wasn't in the conversation at all, just walked up and punched me in the stomach. He sucker punched me. And I was like, and I remember in that moment, my worldview, one of my core beliefs, went from the world is a relatively safe place to the world's not safe. The world is a place where people can just randomly walk up and hit you for no apparent reason. And I remember I had a really hard time like regaining my composure. I started crying and I just couldn't stop. Like, and I think it was as much that idea as it was, I wasn't in so much pain.
No, it was
just
grief.
This shock.
It was grief. This loss
and
of
so I think,
safety.
You know, that was the point where I really bought whole hog into the man box culture. How are we for swearing on this podcast, Sarah?
It's good. It's all good. We're an open forum.
Okay. So my response was, fuck this. I am never showing my emotions again. My emotions had just humiliated me and I was not having it. And mm-hmm. so I decided to put the mask on, and that's what people would see. They would see calm, cool, and collected all the time. And, you know, it worked for a minute. We know that you can't bottle up what you're feeling, that it will just come back and bite you in the ass in a bigger way later.
And let me interrupt for a second. And
yeah.
It ends up limiting your potential for relationship and true connection, which is kind of the
point. Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. I wasn't even to that point at that, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't start dating till later in high school. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Because it does limit the depth and the connection, the authenticity. And then I remember, you know, I just put my all into achieving, and I really became an overachiever. And part of this was the culture of my family, the expectations. You know, it was kind of, I would bring home all A's and a B, and they'd be like,
what's
well, John, what about this B?
Wait, how many kids?
What's up with that?
How many kids?
Two.
And you're the...
And so I've got an older sister by a year and a half.
Okay.
And, you know, our family's quite German, and so that, you know, it was, for many years, it was pretty emotionally repressed. and very action, achievement, doing oriented.
And
my parents are great people. I mean, they're amazing, each of them in their own right. But this was just, you know,
culture.
I would say a weakness that was in our family. So I'm a, you know, very emotionally sensitive kid in an emotionally vacuous family.
Yeah.
And so I did what I needed to survive. So by the time I was a senior in high school, if you looked at it from the outside, I was killing it. Like, I was student body president. I was captain of three varsity teams. I was taking advanced classes. And from the inside, my experience was I was anxious and stressed much of the time. I was depressed some of the time because I couldn't achieve my way out of my depression, although that was the strategy. I was exhausted much of the time because I was just going all the time. I had friends getting mad at me because I didn't have enough time for them. And it started me questioning this whole idea of success because I just wasn't feeling it. I was like, where this success isn't making sense to me. I'm doing everything the adults around me tell me I need to do to be successful. And where is there room in this idea for things like happiness, relaxation, contentment? You know, I think there was some pride in there, but in general, I was running so hard and so fast to do that there was no enjoyment, there was no relaxation, there was no happiness. And so at 17, I started looking at this and I didn't have any answers. But I think that was kind of the fracture, the first fissure in the mask where I was like, yeah, this doesn't work.
Yeah, I can't achieve my way into happiness. I keep getting these achievements and hitting these success points, but they're not making me happy. Yeah, it reminds me of how I describe people who are bipolar, which is they think, well, if I just get this job, I'll be happy. Or if I just make this much money, I'll be happy. Or if I just get this kind
bipolar,
of
bipolar, see, I just think that's normal.
I
think that's human.
It is to a certain extent, except that bipolar people will continue to reach for those kinds of achievements or things, and they never actually get happy. And some people, I think the majority of people, find moments of happiness in those achievements. But it seems like, well, anyway, I'm not a psychologist. Well, you are.
But I mean, here's why I think that's just human, is because I think we're all fed this bullshit story of, you know, get good grades, get in the best college you can, graduate college, get the best job you can, find someone along the way, get married, have kids, make more money, get promoted, make more money, and then you retire at 65, and then you'll be happy.
Ugh, what a horrible way
and
to live.
It's such bullshit, because if we're not taught the skills and tools of how to manage our minds and our hearts and how to actually be happy, you're not going to be happy at 65 either. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I can't tell you how many men I've talked to that are, you know, about 50-ish years old and have done everything that they should have done by that measure. Mm-hmm. And they're just miserable.
Right.
So I think we're fed a bill of goods. I think we're fed a line. And, you know, at some level, I imagine that's to create good workers. But I think that there's way more to it than that.
Well, and I think we're experiencing a renaissance of that now, of people realizing that there's more and that they're not experiencing it.
Right. And so, you know, going back to the man box culture, my story, let's see. So, you know, I got into a PhD program at UC Berkeley in psychology. And part of that was really to help me figure out how to manage my own emotions. Because, you know, the dumbest, most embarrassing, most shameful stuff I've done in my life came when my emotional mind was in charge of me. You know, when I was angry, when I was
isn't
anxious,
that usually
or stressed,
the case?
When I was bored.
People,
I think it's almost always the case.
Yeah,
if you and I are calm, cool, and collected, you know, we're not going to say anything that's really hurtful to each other.
Right. Right.
But if we get in an argument and we get really angry, then...
Or if we're already angry and we get triggered.
Right. So, you know, Berkeley was all about cognitive psychology. So that's about how we think and not so much about emotional psychology because, you know, there wasn't really much research on emotions back in the late 90s because it's just a hard topic to do research on. It's squishy. Mm-hmm. And how do you start doing research on a group of subjects? How do you ensure that they're all in the same place emotionally to measure the effectiveness of an intervention, for example?
Right.
So, you know, I got out, I was a school psychologist. I remember I was working in high school and the best part of my job was these high school students coming in and sharing their stories with me, which was exactly what they were supposed to do. But I didn't realize at that time, and I was probably 25 then, that emotions are contagious. So you can catch emotions from mm-hmm. other people if you're not trained to do otherwise.
Right. To set that boundary.
And you have to have some emotional awareness to do that. You have to have some tools to do that, which is funny because no one in therapy or psychology ever gets taught that in their training that I've seen, which is a real blind spot. But anyway.
Right. Well, we talk about empathy and holding somebody else's energy, absorbing it rather than being able to reflect it.
Well, and I would say letting it pass through me because I want to feel it. I want to know what they're doing and what they're feeling and thinking, but, and those are how you feel is a great tell on that. But I think of myself as a giant fishing net stretched across a river and that water is just rushing at me. Oh. And the vast majority of it, I would say, is negative emotion because of the negativity bias in our minds. We overfocus on the negative things in life, emotions, thoughts, self-definitions. Mm-hmm. And I would say, I don't know, 70 to 80% of it's negative, 20, 30% positive. And so all of it just passes through me on a second by second basis. But the good stuff in that water just kind of magically sticks to my fishing net. Compliments, smiles, kind words.
That's what you choose to absorb. Yeah.
Right.
Huh.
But at, good visual. At 25, I didn't. Well, and metaphors are important when it comes to emotion. How we think of them is a big deal. When I was a kid, I used to think of myself as a bucket and you know, that doesn't work very well because it gets filled.
Right.
And then you go volcanic. So anyway, so I'm meeting with these high school students and this was a kind of a sketchy area of town and they had some real stuff that they were dealing with and their stories were filled with fear, anger, sadness, grief, trauma. And I was just taking it all in because I didn't know how to do otherwise. And it ended up with me getting depressed. Mm-hmm. And when you get depressed, inflammation in the body goes up, it increases. So any old injuries that you had kind of come back. And for me, it's my low back. And I remember my back went out and I'm depressed and in pain. And, you know, I'm lying on the floor of my office and, you know, hope jumps out the window and I'm thinking, okay, this is fucking ridiculous. Like here I am a psych trained at Cal and I still can't manage my own emotions. And if I can't do that, how can I teach them to?
Right. How do I help?
And so laying on that floor, I made a conscious decision that I would look for the best scientifically proven tools to manage the dark side of things. Mainly fear, anger, sadness in all their variations. Mm-hmm. And that worked. It was really helpful to have this, the beginning of a toolbox to teach to others. And you know, right there, that's kind of traditional psychology. Traditional psychology is how do we get you from miserable to surviving? And if we get you from -5 to 0, then we can kind of dust our hands off and go, whoo, I did my work. I'm done. I am out of here. Thank you very much. My name is Dr. John.
You are now fixed. You're healed.
You're now just as miserable as the rest of them.
No more.
And then, you know, positive psychology came along and that shows us how to get from 0 to +5.
Right. I was wondering when that was going to come in, the positive psychology.
Yeah. Well, okay. So, I left school psychology because I got disgusted with some things that were going on in that school district, things that I realized I could never fix if I stayed there for my whole career. Teachers coming to school drunk, a resource teacher brought up on molestation charges. Like, there's just some weird stuff.
Wait, can we back up just a little? Hold that thought.
Sure.
No, hold that thought about when you left and ended up getting into positive psychology. But I'd like to go back to that pivotal moment where you're laying on your back on the floor in your office. And
yes,
you're thinking, there has to be more than this because I don't feel like I'm helping people. And I know you now, after talking to you a few times, that mm-hmm. is probably the most painful realization, is that you can't help the people that you really want to serve, that you are devoted to serving. And you feel like if you're suffering, you can't possibly be in a position to help them. What was the next interaction with a student that you remember that maybe has like this vivid recall?
Well, you know, I think that pivotal moment, as you describe it, one of the ways we're trained as psychologists and mental health professionals is to be the sounding board, to be the blank slate, the tabula rasa.
Right.
And so we're not supposed to share anything of our personal life with the client, or, you know, as in the old school, they would call them patients. I don't call them that. And I realized that that was complete and utter bullshit. That actually what we're trying to do is not psychotherapy. We're not trying to, you know, don't muddy the waters by, you know, putting any of my stuff into their stuff. We're actually trying to create an authentic relationship in a place that is safe and secure, so that they can learn new tools and then practice those tools so that they can then take them out into the real world and put them into play. And in order to create an authentic relationship, one has to be authentic. One has to model authenticity and vulnerability.
Yes.
And how do you
yes.
do that but share parts of yourself when you think it's in service to your client, not, you know, just anything. But
right,
you know, there's a lot of stories that I have that yeah. make people feel normal about what their struggles are.
Mm-hmm. Where you can relate and they can look at you and go, oh, mm-hmm. this guy can actually relate.
I mean, now when I have a client come in, a new client, I will share much of my story with them in an attempt to normalize what they're going through before I even know what it is they're going through. I, you know, typically I've got a guess, but I mean, for most men, it's okay, you probably feel. So
right.
let me share with you my trials and tribulations with the emotional mind.
So was there a student where you did that as an experiment, like not maybe intentionally, but you just kind of decided?
Yeah, I think it became more and more my style. And I remember I was also in a middle school, and this is when I was like a trainee, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I knew nothing, and I'm still working on that. But
tell me about it.
So you never feel like you know enough.
Right, exactly.
Because you never do. But I remember I had this, in middle school, I had a group of eight boys who were the most ADHD students in the whole school.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized over time that I was just babysitting, mm-hmm. and anything that I could teach them above and beyond that was just gravy. So anyway, there's this, even within this group of eight ADHD boys, there was a social hierarchy, a pecking order. And at the bottom of this pecking order was this kid, let's call him Todd. And he was at the bottom of every social hierarchy in the school. And so he was just miserable on a few levels.
Right.
And I remember they were all kind of on the other side of a U-shaped table. And I was sitting in a chair in the middle. And I don't even remember what I said. But this, and I knew he was agitated that morning. And I obviously didn't know what it was about because we hadn't even gotten that far. But I said something and he jumped over the table and came at me with a fist as if to hit me in the face. And So I sat back in my chair and I just watched him. Because one of the things that one of my best professors at Cal said, Meiji Singh, he's a Sikh Indian, very brilliant, gentle man. He said, never give your clients what they're expecting. If you give them what they're expecting, you've failed. And I've always loved that philosophy. And so I watch him. I didn't make a move to stop him. And he stopped his fist about an inch from my nose. And I thought, huh, this kid does have some self-control after all.
And that's a good moment. You know,
going back to Meiji's advice, I was like, okay, so every time this kid has done this, and he's done this, he's been told to go to the vice principal for discipline. He's been threatened with expulsion or suspension. And so I said, okay, I got to give him something different. So I said, well, look, you've got a choice. You can go back to class or you can return to your seat. And his head kind of sagged and he sheepishly turned around and went back to his chair and sat down. And then I turned to the boys in the group and I said, so what did y'all see? And they said, well, he jumped the table and came at you in anger and threw a punch at you. And I said, and then what? And they're like, and you didn't do anything. You didn't even get angry. And, you know, I didn't think much of it at the time. I was exhausted after that group. I can tell you that just because of, you know, all the emotion that I'm trying to maintain at that point. Mm-hmm. But I got a call from every one of those kids' moms in the next year saying, do you do individual therapy? My son had a group with you and he would really like to work with you.
Oh.
Now, I couldn't do that at the time because I didn't have a license or anything, but I just, that hindsight made me realize like, wow, that was a really powerful, in your vocabulary, a pivotal moment for them. They had never seen anger not met with anger.
Mm.
Anger was always met with anger. From a mom, from a dad, from a student, from a teacher.
Wow. You know, that just reminded me of my conversation with Joe Kwan during one of my podcast recordings a few years ago, maybe a year and a half ago, where he said that if you match the energy, and he wasn't talking about anger with anger necessarily, but the level of energy, not necessarily the type of energy, mm-hmm. that it allows that person to not feel like they have to shut you down or dismiss you. So his example was a toddler that's throwing a tantrum. If you sit down and throw a tantrum with them, they're going to, you know, it's going to escalate. If you go in with a happy, everything's going to be okay, it's going to escalate. But if you sit down and match their energy level, that they'll feel like you can be there with them. You can sit mm-hmm. in it with them. And it feels like that's kind of what you did was it was a calm energy, but it was still the match so that he felt like he didn't need to keep going. Mm-hmm. I don't know. For some reason, I'm feeling a really strong connection there and I don't think I'm describing it very well.
Well, I think that, you know, in couples, let's say as an example, when one person is getting really angry, and like a lot of times I'll teach my clients to stay calm in the face of anger, mm-hmm. often a spouse's anger. And when you first do that, the person that's still getting angry has a tendency to get ramped up even more. They will get angrier because when we're angry, we want the other person to match us in emotion and intensity. And when we don't do that, we'll escalate more and get angrier in an attempt to bait them and get them to join us. Now, that's not conscious. That's subconscious.
Right. Yep.
But it's a very common dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen that. So it's really kind of a very careful choreographed dance when you see it coming mm-hmm. to you, because you don't want to get angry with them, but you also don't want to escalate it. Do you have a strategy that you've used personally when that happens? Because I've done it with my kids, but for some reason, I don't necessarily do that so well with my mom, which, you know, we have a great relationship, but there's definitely friction there. And I really have been not great at it with my husband, which just the other night, I suggested something that was bothering me, and it it was not met well. And I thought, oh my gosh, Sarah, you're a communication coach and you totally fucked that up. So like, I understand that you have to take that step back, but what have you used as a strategy when you can't match their energy with anger, but you also can't dismiss it because then it's worse?
Well, I mean, that's a whole book right there. It's a great question. And I mean, it makes me think, when I first started experimenting with these tools for myself around anger, I was towards the end of my marriage. And my wife at that time accused me of having an anger problem. And after I got through the initial anger of being accused of that.
Defensiveness, right?
Yeah. There's so much to share here. There's this great line by Bradley, I think it's Bradley Whitmore, who is an actor on the West Wing, because I want to credit the source. But he says, whenever a director gives me criticism or feedback, I go through three stages internally. The first one is fuck you. The second one is I suck. And the third one is, wait, what? And I think that's so powerful, because it's anger externalized, then it's anger internalized. And when and if you can get past those two, then you can consider the information.
With curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
That's
and I
so
think
cool.
Most men get stuck in that first phase often. Or yes. You know, if they're good, it's the second phase.
Well, especially if their father was like that, and that's what they modeled.
Right. So, God, there's so many ways to go here. So anyway, back to the ex-wife situation. So she accused me of having this anger problem. I'm like, after I get through fuck you and I suck, I'm like, okay, well, let me take a look at that. I'll take my part in that equation. And so I worked on it, and I got to the point where I could stay calm even when she was yelling at me when I had done nothing wrong, which was somewhat frequent. And what I would do is I would sit there and I would split my attention in two. So 70% of my attention, I'm focused on her and responding appropriately. Yes, honey. Yep. I got you. I hear you. I understand what you're saying. Yeah, I can work on that. And with the other 30%, I'm coaching myself in my own head. Breathe. Relax. This has nothing to do with you. This is not about me. This is her stuff. And I would just keep going through that over and over and over. And when you do that, it becomes really apparent who has the actual anger problem. Mm. And so, you know, that's part of it. I think part of it is learning stress management techniques. I think part of it is learning relaxation techniques. Part of it is on training your body to know what it feels like to be relaxed, period, so that you can come back to that state more frequently, and so that you have a prayer of coming back to that state when things start to escalate. Part of it is learning self-compassion, to speak to yourself with some kindness. Part of it is filling up that bucket of positive emotion so you have more internal resources to draw from before you get to that state of anger or irritation. Part of it is learning appropriate assertiveness so we can speak up more quickly when, you know, if you think of anger on a 1 to 10 scale of intensity, with 1 being calm and 10 being incredible Hulk enraged. I'm a superhero geek. Marvel, not DC. That, you know, so many tangents. So 1 to 10 scale, 1 being calm, 10 being enraged. You have to get in front of anger before it gets to a 5 on that scale. If you go above a 5, I would argue you become anger. There's very little rational you left.
Right, because you're out of
and
your
that's where you say things
prefrontal
and do
cortex.
Things.
Now you're in your right. Amygdala takeover.
So by training yourself to spend more time in the present moment, by training yourself to get your attention out of your head and into your body, because emotions are embodied, most of the cues or tells for an emotion are in your body. So if you can begin to go, oh, huh, I'm starting to get a little bit annoyed. I wonder what's going on. Oh, hey, Sarah, you know, would you bring the volume of your voice down a little bit? Or Sarah, I need you to speak to me with more respect than what you're doing right now. You know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That's appropriate assertiveness. And it, you know, all these are tools that you can learn. They take repetition. They take work. And it's all possible. It's all doable.
Mm. I keep coming back
and
to...
And by the way, this doesn't mean that we're going to get rid of anger. We're still going to get angry at times. And then you have to have self-compassion when you do screw up.
Right. Because you have another opportunity to practice not doing it next time.
That's right.
Yeah. You just brought up two strategies that I use with my coaching clients. And I say the word curiosity a lot. And that's what that, wait, what? Question is, is approaching that with curiosity, that first of all, approaching the feedback with curiosity or the criticism. And then the other is curiosity about why you felt so defensive as a result of it. And it's fascinating to me because I still struggle with certain people's feedback. And one of the things that I did years ago, I was in a really tough situation with a boss that was really mean to me. And every opportunity she had, she would really take me down. My confidence was in the toilet. And we had this half-year evaluation because she decided that we needed to follow up on the first one. And she had this laundry list of things that I was doing wrong. And they were mostly just really personal, had nothing to do with the work I was doing. But right before this meeting, I had found out that she had invited her boss to join us. And oh my gosh, I was just in a panic because I knew her boss managed in a similar way to how she managed. So really micromanagement and nitpicky about time clock and stuff that really shouldn't be part of your conversation when you're a successful professional. But I remember like taking a little walk right before that meeting and my friend Marcia Polis, who does Polis Pilates, she's just this amazing human. And she said, Sarah, when you're in that room, imagine that there's a video camera recording this and think about how you would want to see yourself watching this recording in a year or 5 years. How would you want to see yourself there? So I'm sitting in this room, and I wrote this story in the book. I'm sitting in this room with my boss and her boss, and my boss is just going through this laundry list of what a horrible person I am. And I'm looking at her, and every once in a while, I would kind of lean back, and I'd get this little Mona Lisa smile on my face. And I was just listening. And when she would say something insulting, I would say, oh, I could see why you felt like that. This is where I thought that conversation went. And I stayed so calm because I was imagining watching myself on this later and thinking, I want to make sure that I handle this with grace and compassion. And then the last word that popped into my head was dignity. I don't want to be stepped on, but I also want to be compassionate because I know this isn't about me. I know this is about her struggles with power and home issues. And so that's the tool that I give my clients a lot, but I hadn't really turned that back on myself until you just said that those three stages. What was his name? Bradley?
I think it's Whitmore.
Oh, Whitmore. Okay. I'll look it up because I want to include that in the show notes on this blog post with the podcast. But the
I love the quote.
Yeah, fuck you, I suck. And wait, what?
It was funny. I got to tell you the story. Awesome. So I was talking, pardon me, I was talking to a client yesterday whom I love, and he's 15. And he was relaying to me that his family was having dinner the other night and his dad was getting on himself because he thought he was eating fast food too often. He was trying to lose weight and someone in the family gave him some criticism and he started to escalate and get a little bit irritated and his voice started to rise. And my client said to you, said to him, oh my gosh, I gotta share with you what Dr. John taught me. He said the first stage you go through is fuck you. I was like, oh no. They're like, wait, what? And he's like, well, hold on. Like, let me get through the whole thing. And he got through the whole thing and they were like, oh my gosh. The mom was like, Can you text that to me? I want to take that to work. Took it to work the next day at like Verizon, like shared it with all our employees and I don't know. It just cracked me up. I'm like,
awesome.
Oh great, yeah. Dr. John's telling you fuck you.
Yeah. That's awesome. I love that. First of all, I think the reason that's so sticky beside it being so damn accurate, is that it starts with a little bit of a shocker. It starts with something really memorable, something that, at least in my circles, I don't hear that regularly. I don't use that language often. It's not every other word in my vocabulary. And so it's startling enough to capture your attention. And oh my gosh, I'm definitely going to put that in the show.
And that's actually why I do swear relatively frequently, is because I'm trying to speak to men, but also because I think there's swear words can be used to increase emotional intensity. Mm-hmm. And we remember things better when there's more emotion involved. Mm-hmm. Plus, I try and use them on a more positive note, like, I'm so fucking proud of you.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, think of the difference, but if your husband says, love you, honey, versus I am so fucking in love with you.
No, that doesn't work for me. That doesn't, no. As a matter of fact, if I heard my husband say that, I would ask who just took over his brain.
Well, I mean, to me, it's a difference because in intensity. Again, it's that intensity scale.
And I think it's because if he said, I am so fucking proud of you, I would be like, oh. But if he said, I love you so fucking much, that would ruin a tender moment. I think there's a difference, especially with women, that love is tender. I mean, there are women, of course, who would prefer that way of doing it. But when I think of love, I think of tenderness. And
So think of it this way, because to me, there's different intensities of love or different gears. Mm-hmm. And so I don't see love as always tender. I see it as sometimes it can be aggressive, sometimes it can be possessive, sometimes it can be intense. Same as sex, right? I think there's differences in how we make love. Mm-hmm. I think there's making love, there's screwing, and there's fucking.
Well, when I want to
And those
be
are
told,
different degrees.
When I want to be told an intensity of I love you, I want it to be a full body hug and eye to eye, and I want to feel it more than I want to hear the words. So, and I think that's a really important distinction here, is that we do things differently. We do want things differently. And if I were to say, I love you so fucking much to my husband, he would think something was wrong. I mean, because that's just not the language we use in our relationship. But if he did something really awesome, like he got me a kayak for my birthday this year, and he was worried that I would think it was kind of like getting me an iron, because this is something we do together. Like it would be, and I said, oh my gosh, I love this. This is so awesome. And then when we went kayaking, we threw that boat in the truck and drove out so I could get it in the water and christen it in the lake. And I said, look at this awesome fucking boat. And that was intensity. And that's where, that's where we would see that in our relationship.
That sounds like heaven to me.
Well, yeah, it is. And the language in has to be in context to be meaningful for both people.
Absolutely. And so I take it that one of your love languages, one of your top ones, is touch.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Affection. And I don't know that it was always that way, but I read this great article in National Geographic probably 10 or 12 years ago. And it was on the topic of love and long-term relationships. And the conclusion they came to after interviewing people who had been married 5 years, 10 years, up to 50 or 60 years, was that the longevity of relationships, healthy relationships, let me back that up a little, as far as what we can see in a relationship, obviously we don't necessarily know. But as far as they could tell, in healthy, long relationships, longevity was directly related to physical affection. And one woman who had been married for over 50 years, she said, of course I get angry with him. When I'm angry, I force myself to put my hand on his shoulder or hold his hand or kiss him on the head. And it's not, I forgive you because you're being an asshole. It's what it is for her. And now that we know what's released, our endorphins are released when we do that. We get a boost of dopamine when we do that.
Oxytocin.
Sorry. Yes. Thank you. we get that boost of oxytocin.
Yeah, and, I mean, that's a repair attempt to me.
Yeah.
That's an attempt to repair the rift that the anger just caused.
Exactly.
And the faster you can repair those rifts, the better off you're going to be.
Exactly. So touch, affection counteracts that shot of cortisol. And I have to say, there are times when I don't want to touch him, when I'm just angry. But I force myself to put my hand on his shoulder. And he may be really prickly. Well, he may shrug away. But I've gotten, you know, I've stopped it at least temporarily. Because I know that, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, the majority of people, that works. But there are people on the autism spectrum that that would absolutely counteract or contradict.
Well, and I mean, some, you know, possible repair attempts are an apology, touch, a hug, a bad joke, eye contact, moving closer to your loved one. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things they find in successful couples is that they make more frequent repair attempts, they make them sooner, and then also they practice receiving those repair attempts well.
Oh, that makes so much sense. You just like answered so many questions about my marriage.
So, I mean, like if you touch your husband after an argument or during, and he's like, he shrugs and shrugs and shrugs and keeps shrugging off those touches, after a while, it discourages you from trying.
Right.
And so, yeah. And I sometimes, you know, my fiance and I will even say, hey, honey, this is me making a repair attempt.
Oh. But it can't
and
be
then,
the same
you know, you're,
person
you're like,
doing
oh,
it every
fuck.
Time.
Like, really? I got to take this repair attempt? Son of a...
Yeah.
but you know what's going on, right?
Like, yeah, but you can't be the one that, to do it all the time. I mean, the other person has to...
Oh, it's got to go back and forth. Right.
Yeah.
And that's... But I think if you know the importance of repair attempts, if you know the concept, then you can both... And I think the other part of it that's really, really important, which kind of goes to your point of you have to make the repair attempt before you feel like it.
Yes.
If you wait for your feeling to change, you could wait a long time and you're not going to feel better until that rift gets repaired.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Huh. So you could still be angry and hurt and go, shit, I got to make another repair attempt. And a lot of times you make a repair attempt and your partner isn't in a space to hear it because they're hurt because the last repair attempt was, you know, rebuffed. And so you keep missing, you know, you alternate making repair attempts, but you have to keep making the repair attempts until it's met well, until you guys meet and go, okay, yeah, I forgive you. Or like, let's just get past this.
Right.
Or I love you.
Right. Huh.
So much to share. I mean, they're like,
yeah, we could go on and on. We probably hit our limit, but we could do this all afternoon, I think.
Yeah. Sorry for swearing so much on your podcast.
That's okay. Let's just come full
That's
circle.
That's the most F-bombs I've ever had.
Oh no, not even. I just interviewed Kenny Aronoff. Do you know who Kenny Aronoff is? That'll be in so Kenny Aronoff is a famous drummer. He traveled with John Cougar Mellencamp and Melissa Etheridge. And so he's, his was more, but not a lot more.
Okay.
So let's just come.
Well, hopefully it
circle.
Doesn't offend your listeners. It's all for a good cause.
Of course. Well, okay, as we said, there are reasons, you know, there are appropriate times and there are inappropriate times. And, we can actually bring this right back full circle to that whole idea of an evolved caveman or cavewoman and understanding the context of language and being able to separate yourself from somebody else's emotions, letting them wash through you. It all comes together in that context of how do we evolve? How do we continue to grow and become happier people, more satisfied in our lives? And that's what you do with your podcast, right? That's really where you focus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that was well put. I think the other thing is, what are we evolving towards? So what's the goal? And to me, the framework for happiness that I've laid out is happiness is all about relationships. And there's four types of relationships that we're focusing on. There's relationship to self, there's relationship to others, and a big one of that is your significant other or romantic mm-hmm. relationship. There's relationship to work. And, you know, one of the keys there is meaningful work. Mm-hmm. They did the Harry's masculinity study in, I think it was 2018, 2019, found that for men, the number one predictor of happiness is meaningful work. And then the fourth one is relationship to something larger than yourself. So it could be God, higher power, spirituality, community. Volunteerism, yeah. a mission, right? But those are, you know, kind of what we're looking to connect with and work on.
Yeah, it sounds like what we do is really, really complementary. So if our listeners would like to get in touch with you or learn more about what you do, can you tell me a little bit about that just so that our listeners can look you up? And sure. I will have links to all of this in the blog post, the show notes.
Thanks. The podcast is The Evolved Caveman, and it's on all major platforms. There's a site that goes with it, theevolvedcaveman.com. There's my coaching site is guidetoself.com. And if you want to take a look at that, the conference that we just put out, that is at survivingtothriving.site, S-I-T-E.
Survivingtothriving.site. Okay.
Yes, site.
And the guide to self what?
.com.
Guidetoself.com. Excellent. Well, I will put those in the show notes so that our listeners can connect with you. And should I put your LinkedIn information as well?
Sure, that's fine. I mean, great. You know, Instagram is The Evolved Caveman.
Okay.
I'm not so advanced that I have it consistent across social media platforms, but it's a work in progress.
Yeah, well, your strength is relationships. So
not marketing.
Let's lean into that. I know. Tell me about it. I was just thinking about that in my own business. So I feel it. John, thank you so much for spending this time with me.
Hey.
It's really been full of incredible insights and thoughtful stories, and I just really appreciate it.
Yeah, Sarah, I always have a blast talking with you. Like, it's just, it feels like home.
I was thinking the same thing. I'm glad you said those words. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Your Stories Don't Define You, How You Tell Them Will. If you're planning an event or company retreat and want to bring in a memorable, entertaining, and highly practical speaker as your keynote speaker or workshop facilitator, please visit us at elkinsconsulting.com to learn how we can help and provide a memorable keynote or breakout session. Thank you. I look forward to hearing from you.
Now listen to me, honey, while I say, how could you tell?